It's the morning show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The state of Wisconsin credits the forest industry with 61,000 jobs. That includes both full and part-time work. And it's pretty obvious to notice when companies harvest timber or operate large paper mills. Paper converters, though, aren't as visible, but they're still part of Wisconsin's paper economy. They take raw paper materials from mills and they elevate them and add value. What questions do you have about paper converters? Join the conversation now. Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Bovey is a wood product specialist and a professor in the College of Agriculture with the UW-Madison Division of Extension, and he's ready to talk paper converters. Scott, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
We just talked very briefly, a brief explanation about what paper converters are. Can you give me an example of the work that a paper converter does?
Well, certainly. I think most of your listeners can imagine a giant roll of paper coming out of one of Wisconsin's paper mills, the type of roll that you would need an overhead crane to move. And if you think about it, that giant roll may not be that useful for most of us. So what do you do to that giant roll to make it more useful? And that's what paper converters do. They take those giant rolls of paper and convert them or add value to them to make a useful product. So one example might be specialty paper that's used for microwave popcorn bags. They will take those rolls. They may have to add certain coatings and other finishes to that paper. And then they will fashion that product into a microwave popcorn bag. So that's essentially what converters do. They take the large raw material rolls and convert them into something more useful.
That's a very accessible answer, I think, for most of us. You're one of the authors of a recent study with the Wisconsin Paper Council that looks at the paper conversion industry statewide. What products are the most common?
Well, certainly we have a real diversity of converters in the state. We have everything from, you know, office type paper that everyone can think of, copy paper, to a range of specialty products. I mentioned the popcorn bag. There's other food packaging products that are really on the cutting edge today of how do we use paper for packaging that's maybe more accessible than those plastic bubble wraps that are very difficult to open with a knife or scissors. You know, how do we produce products that are useful and also have a small environmental footprint when compared to other non-renewable materials like plastic, for example. Another example might be the fabric that you see in medical gowns. So if you go to the emergency room, the medical staff there will have disposable gowns on that, you know, protect not only themselves, but the patient as well. So there's numerous products that we make here in Wisconsin that are different than, you know, like my first example, just simple copy paper.
Your study finds that paper converters generate almost $11 billion in yearly input, also employing more than 19,000 people. Why are they doing this well in Wisconsin?
Well, I think we certainly have a long history of papermaking in the state, and that has a lot to do with our fantastic forest resource that we have here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has also done a pretty good job of being innovative in the types of products that they make. So we can probably think of certain paper types that are declining. So one example would be the aforementioned copy paper. Another example would be newsprint. So those are types of paper that we're starting to use less of over time. You know, what's interesting is, you know, for the past 30 plus years since the advent of the personal computer, people have talked about how that printer paper, copy paper market is going to decline. Well, it's taken that many years for it to finally happen. You started seeing declines, certainly in Wisconsin, about the time that COVID hit because of, you know, people not going to the office. So Wisconsin has done a pretty good job of adapting to those changing marketplaces and producing certain specialty papers that will have a long future ahead of them. And certainly some of the packaging materials that I mentioned earlier, whether they're food packaging or other types of packaging, are becoming more important as our sort of purchase trends change. So think for a minute about how online shopping has become such a big part of our economy, especially during the pandemic. If you think about the packaging required to get those products to your house, certainly at least one more level of packaging than you would have if those same products were being shipped to a brick and mortar store. So those types of markets, whether it be simple corrugated boxes that are used in shipping to specialty packaging that actually surrounds the goods that we buy, are growing market segments.
We are talking about Wisconsin's paper conversion industry with Scott Bovee. He's a professor and also a wood product specialist. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can ask your question about converting paper into different products here in Wisconsin. And Scott, when you're thinking about the process, the supply chain of paper, and you're talking about how we've made adjustments, tell us about the connection between paper converters and then the mills that are so easy to notice here in Wisconsin.
Sure. And I think what we should do is let's take one more step backward and connect it to the forest. Certainly, I mentioned before how people can imagine a giant roll of paper being lifted by a crane coming off one of Wisconsin's paper machines. Prior to that paper mill where that sheet is actually formed, we actually have pulp mills. And pulp mills, they're often, you know, on the same grounds or the same facility as the paper mill, but the pulp mill is the part of the process where they actually take pulpwood or round wood from Wisconsin's forests and actually convert that into the actual fiber that's going to be used to make the paper. And that fiber, after it's produced, would be called pulp. And of course, that pulp is then mixed with you know, a lot of water and other additives and is actually fed into the paper machine to actually produce the sheet. So first, we have certainly forest management in Wisconsin. We have our forest industry that's actually doing the on-the-ground management, the harvesting, the trucking. All of that is part of the process to get the material to the pulp mill. Then that pulp mill actually converts that raw pulpwood, the actual round wood, into the actual fiber that's used to make the paper. And then from the paper mill, of course, those value-added converters take those large rolls and add value to them. So that's the chain from all the way from forest management in the forest through to the secondary or the converter companies that actually add value. So it's a significant amount of manufacturing that goes on. But what's interesting in my mind is that if you compare paper products to other sort of non-renewable products, whether it be plastic or metal or other non-renewables, paper has a smaller environmental footprint than using those non-renewable products. So if we can find ways to better utilize more innovative ways, like I mentioned earlier on how some of these converters in Wisconsin are coming up with new ideas, new packaging, new products, I think that's an environmental benefit for us as a whole because we're not using non-renewable products.
So you see paper converters as essential to sustainable forest management?
Absolutely. You know, a wise individual that I knew once said that sustainable forests depend upon a sustainable forest industry. So if we do not have a forest industry that's going to utilize raw materials from our forests, we won't be able to manage our forests because very, very few people would have the wealth to be able to manage a forest without actually having some revenue stream come from the harvest. So landowners can actually benefit by doing a timber sale because, of course, they make revenue from that timber sale. But they can take some of that revenue and stick it back into their forest land, whether it be for wildlife habitat or timber stand improvement. ultimately they end up with a healthier forest because of the management that they've done. And without a forest industry, they wouldn't be able to do that.
Scott Bovey is a wood product specialist and a professor in the College of Agriculture with the UW-Madison Division of Extension. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the business of paper converters, why they're successful in Wisconsin, and what's stopping them from growing even more. We welcome your questions. Call 800-642-1234. This conversation continues on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. One industry consultant calls the area between Green Bay and Milwaukee the converting corridor. That's because the area has lots of companies that take initial paper materials from mills and level up their products. Call 800-642-1234 with your questions or comments as we have this conversation. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Bovey is a wood product specialist, and we're talking about paper converters. Scott, where is the paper that Wisconsin paper converters use? Where does it come from?
Well, study results from our study shows that the majority of the paper from our respondents, the converters in the study, does come from Wisconsin. And that's, you know, certainly a bonus for our paper producers here in the state. Other converters buy product that's not produced here in Wisconsin. So other states like Georgia, Maine, Indiana are the source of those papers. But a big part of our production here in Wisconsin is from Wisconsin product, which is good for our economy because it keeps those dollars here in Wisconsin. Keely, you mentioned earlier about the impact of the converting side. If you look at the entire solid wood or forest industry in Wisconsin, it generates close to $24 billion annually. And paper represents about three quarters of that. So the other one quarter would be solid wood, like sawmills or other solid wood producers in the state. Paper would be 75% of that $24 billion number. So it's is certainly a significant impact on our annual economy for the state.
We've seen Wisconsin paper mills close over the last years. Is that affecting these paper converters?
Well, certainly that was a huge impact in Wisconsin. So right as COVID hit a couple of years ago, we had two large paper mills close in the state. And that certainly impacted how we managed our forests and markets for that pulpwood that come from Wisconsin's forests. So that sent ripples across the state. What was really important about that is that did we produce enough paper for the converters in the state at the time? Certainly at the height of COVID, when there were high demands for packaging and other materials, converters were having trouble finding the paper stock that they needed to produce their product. So all of that is connected and certainly has impacts not only the converters that depend upon the large roll paper raw material, but also how we manage our forests in the state.
What's the status of those supply concerns now?
Well, over time, of course, things will moderate and level out. But certainly, if the paper doesn't come from Wisconsin, it's going to come from somewhere else based on demand. And we are operating in a global marketplace. So product will come from other parts of the globe to fill those needs. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we better off producing product in the state, or are we better off buying product from elsewhere? I mentioned earlier the difference between a pulp mill and a paper mill, where the pulp mills actually take round wood and produce the pulp that the paper mills use. We certainly do buy pulp from other countries, specifically South America. And one proposed study that we have looking into the future is, let's look at the environmental footprint of pulp that's produced locally versus pulp that is imported from South America. Which one is going to have the smaller environmental footprint? I suspect that the locally produced pulp will have the smaller environmental footprint just because of the lack of excess shipping, et cetera, to bring that product from a continent away. The other thing to be concerned about is, what is the economic impact? Certainly, locally produced product is going to have a more positive economic impact on Wisconsin's economy because it produces jobs and other outputs that will positively impact Wisconsin's economy.
We're talking about Wisconsin's paper conversion industry with Scott Bovey. He's a professor and also a wood product specialist. So speaking of labor then, Scott, your research into Wisconsin's paper converter shows that these companies face labor shortages. How many people are we talking? How many people do these companies need?
Well, that's interesting because that wasn't just paper converting. If you look at industry across Wisconsin, everyone is struggling to find labor plus skilled and qualified labor. And one of the results from the study showed that nearly 75% of our responding companies said that they were between 1 and 19 positions short in their operations. So that's a question, not only focusing on paper, but a broader question, because how do we provide skilled labor for all types of positions across the state, whether it's manufacturing or other types of jobs? Do we have the training mechanisms in place to produce those future workers?
What kind of training do you need to work at a paper converter?
Well, it depends on the position. Certainly, there are many positions where they can be trained in-house, all the way to positions that would require a four-year degree focusing on material science in some fashion. We have paper engineering degrees that are offered at UW-Stevens Point, for example, that would be useful not only in the paper mill industry, but also in the converting industry. So there's a host of training that, depending upon which level you'd work at in the paper mill.
What do you see Wisconsin leaders doing to help support the state's paper converters?
Well, that's a tough question. I think that it fits across so many different aspects of the state. We talked about forest management earlier. How can we promote forest management across the state to be able to produce the raw material that's necessary for those producers? One example is, if you look at sort of growth to removal rate of Wisconsin's forest, it's 1.9 to 1. So that's almost 2 to 1. So we're growing twice what is being removed. So what that tells me is that there's room for expansion in how we manage our forests and how we harvest our forests. We could have a healthier forest if we could actually bring the growth to removal to a more equal amount, where we're not gaining as much volume as we have been in recent years. So again, that goes back to let's keep a healthy forest industry to utilize the product so that we can manage our forests.
And in just our last minute, then, help us understand why harvesting more would make forests healthier.
Well, certainly you can think of examples, especially out west, where we have significant fires, beetle kill, and other things that's kind of the impetus to some of those fires. Certainly in Canada this year, we've suffered from the smoke down here from the fires that are up there. Keeping a healthy forest that's growing vigorously helps it be more resistant to insect and pathogen attack. And keeping those forests properly thin so you don't get the fuel load that builds up, that's all part of that healthy management that we look for.
Scott, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you for joining us this morning.
It's been my pleasure.
Scott Bovey is a wood product specialist and also a professor in the College of Agriculture with the UW-Madison Division of Extension. He talked with us about paper converters. These companies take bulk paper products from mills, and then they make more refined paper goods. They're a crucial part of the supply chain, and business for these companies is doing well in Wisconsin. We have dozens of those businesses here in the state. We talked about why things are going well and what Wisconsin could do to improve the situation for paper converters. You're listening to The Morning Show. Thanks for being with us this morning. And as always, we want to hear your ideas for programs you'd like to hear on The Morning Show. So please, we encourage you to visit our program page to leave suggestions. We've got a web form there for you. The page is wpr.org/mornings. Thank you so much for thinking of us. And our conversations continue here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about being seen.
What's one of the best ways to combat hate? For Jesus Gregorio Smith of Appleton, it's to push back with love. He shares his story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Latino residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
I saw the sign up on Richmond Street in downtown Appleton, and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a sign flashing the F word, the one that rhymes with maggots. It was displayed across a business sign so everyone driving down the road could see it like it was nothing. All I could think about was how could this be possible? Those poor queer kids who already have a hard time with family, within themselves being gay or bi or trans, what happens when they see this sign spewing so much hate? I had to do something. I've experienced my fair share of hatred and bigotry throughout my life. I was born and raised in the little old town of El Paso, Texas. My father, Johnny Smith, is an African-American man who was born in the 1940s, during legal segregation. While Dad was stationed at Fort Bliss, he traveled to Juarez, Mexico, with his fellow soldiers for drinks and fun nights. It's there he fell in love with my mother, Sonia Smith. Once they were married, they had 5 mixed-race children. I'm the youngest of the 5. I had the luxury and honor of having 2 cultural backgrounds and influences in my life. But that luxury also had costs. I recall the first time I was ever called the N-word, and it was by Mexican folks. And I thought to myself, don't we all have it bad enough? Why are we picking on each other? I'll never forget the time my mother gave me this serious talk in first grade, because she was embarrassed with how feminine I was as a child. In fact, the first person to ever call me the F word was my mother. My father instilled a particular vision of Black masculinity that was meant to protect my brothers and I in the world. He stressed that I needed to get a good job in computers in order to be successful. As I got older, I hid my gayness and only pursued paths that would make my family proud, keep me hidden, and keep the comments about me to a minimum. But college didn't lead to a career in computers. Instead, I faced my fears and embraced my identity. I began empowering fellow members of the queer LGBTQIA community. Eventually, I got my PhD in sociology with a focus on race, sexuality, and masculinity. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, a job at Appleton's Lawrence University as an assistant professor of ethnic studies. Which brings me back to that homophobic sign I saw in downtown Appleton. I didn't let the hate deter me. So when I decided to protest under the sign, I gave it up even more to be exactly what the sign said I was. I put on a purple wig, a rainbow shirt, white high heels, and danced around to Born This Way by Lady Gaga. I filmed a silly video and took a photo. The photo went viral on social media. Not too long after, numerous Appleton residents showed up to fight against the hate, resulting in it coming down. I took that viral image, put it on a shirt, and sold it, and raise $15,000 for the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. That is how you turn that hate into love. Through the process of finding oneself, embracing oneself, and living as one's authentic self, one can counter painful experiences and turn them into something different. I tried to hide myself from pain, but when I bravely faced it, I overcame it. It isn't easy, but I think we deserve to see a different world. Determining your own path, despite what others say, can help you break out of molds that confine you. I eventually embraced who I was and made a huge difference in people's lives, as well as my own.
Jesus Gregorio Smith is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. His story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell & Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
It's the morning show. I'm Keeley Boltina. The GOP is working to expand its base across the state of Wisconsin and draw in more people of color. We're talking about it now, and we're taking your questions. You can call 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Gerard Randall is the leader of the Wisconsin African American Council that is part of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, where he is also first vice chair. Gerard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much. You helped land the Republican National Convention. It's set to happen in Milwaukee next year. Republican legislators included $10 million in their state budget plan to help pay for that convention. And then Governor Ito's reduced that funding to $1 million. I just wonder, what's your reaction to that veto?
We're grateful for the amount of money that we received to help stage the convention, which will be occurring next July, and looking forward to the economic activity that it'll bring to the state.
Why do you think, or I guess, do you think state tax dollars should fund any of these partisan conventions?
Well, you look at the economic boost that it brings to the state in terms of hotel rooms, car rentals, the recreational activities that are enjoyed, especially at restaurants. And you can see why that investment is an important investment, because it does ramp up the activity that comes to the state.
And how are you involved in working with bridging the gap between what's needed and the different contractors and the different services that Wisconsin and in particular Milwaukee have?
Well, yes, the whole team is working to make sure that it'll be a successful convention that's staged, that the funding that's necessary in order to put it on will be achieved.
A pretty big effort, though.
I think so.
And what would you say, as you talk about the economic impacts, tell me a little more about how a Republican convention in Wisconsin could benefit people, not just in the area who happen to own businesses or be contractors, but really more widespread for the state?
Well, there are so many different kinds of resources that are going to be needed in order to stage the convention, whether it's caterers or electricians. And so there are ample opportunities for a variety of businesses to be able to participate in the economic activity in staging the convention.
We'll keep an eye on it for sure. Let's talk about affirmative action. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against colleges and universities considering race in admitting students, and you served for more than a decade on the UW System Board of Regents. What do you make of universities striving to make their campuses more diverse?
Well, I do believe that diversity can be achieved, but perhaps in a different way without having to directly consider race. If you look at the reality that many people of color have become members of the great middle class in our state in particular, you can then begin to see how it's probably more important to take a look at economic factors such as one's ability to be able to afford college. And can those scholarships be focused more on people who don't have the wherewithal to attend school? And frankly, many of those that are at the lower end of the economic scale are people of color that would not otherwise be able to afford to attend a public university without some type of support.
So let me clarify then, are you saying that it would be good for universities to strive to make campuses more racially diverse, but we should do it through different means than targeting race?
Absolutely. I don't think you need to target race in order to achieve the diversity, especially ethnic or cultural diversity that you're looking to achieve, given that many of the people of color that you are targeting are those who are also economically disadvantaged.
The Republican-controlled legislature cut $32 million from the UW system budget that was earmarked to improve diversity and equity on campuses. What do you think about state tax dollars funding efforts to improve diversity at those state universities?
Well, again, I would have, if I were the university system, I would have advocated for more funding going into scholarship programs that would support those who are economically disadvantaged as a way to achieve greater diversity on the campuses.
If your goal, though, is to achieve greater diversity on the campuses, including racial diversity, then why go about it from a different angle?
Well, the courts have now determined that using race as a factor is not permissible. And if you still want to have diversity on the campuses, which I think is important, you look at some of the other ways in which you can achieve that diversity. And looking at economic factors, I think, is the better way to go about it. And I argued that when I was on the board.
You have a prominent role in the state's GOP. How do you think politicians and other elected officials should talk about race with voters?
Well, I think voters across the board, whether you're white or African-American, Hmong, Hispanic, have many of the same issues in mind when they go into the polls. They look at economic factors. They look at job security. They look at whether or not their personal safety is being addressed by government. And those are the issues that we focused on in the effort to certainly attract more voters of color to the polls that vote Republican.
During the 2020 campaign season, the Republican Party opened an office in a predominantly Black neighborhood in Milwaukee. Have you seen this outreach effort paying off for the party?
We're very proud of that office and the activity that we've been able to generate through that office. And if you look at the last three election cycles, the number of African Americans in particular that vote Republican or for Republican candidates has steadily increased. And that's what we're looking to continue by having that office as a hub for our candidates that can reach out into the surrounding neighborhoods and across the state in their efforts to carry the Republican message, to make sure that our issues are being heard by everyone. In the past, we, I think, have been reluctant to stretch and target those voters that are not necessarily people who have considered Republican candidates in the past. And this is our effort to reignite some energy into those communities to make sure that the Republican message is heard, that we get feedback from those voters, so that we can fine-tune our message as well.
Gerard Randall is first vice chair of the Wisconsin Republican Party, also leads the state GOP's African American Council. We're talking about work to diversify the state's Republican base. You can join the conversation anytime by calling 800-642-1234. Our discussion continues ahead. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about efforts to grow the base of Black Republicans in Wisconsin with the leader of the state GOP's African American Council. Gerard Randall is first vice chair of the Wisconsin Republican Party. Be part of the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Gerard, one of the strategies that the state GOP is using, we just talked about that outreach effort in a neighborhood in Milwaukee. What other strategies is the party using to attract Black voters?
We're recruiting candidates, and those candidates that can deliver that message more effectively because they understand the communities that we're targeting. They represent the communities that we're targeting. We're also in the past, and will continue in the near future, reaching them through social media. We're looking at how we can extend our reach through radio. Interestingly enough, we've done so in the past. We are also looking at how we can more effectively get volunteers to get out to canvas in our neighborhoods. We've done some of that. We're looking to ramp up that effort more aggressively as the year continues.
We have a caller who's ready to join us, Chris in Hartford. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, as a person of color, the Republican Party kind of lost me in the fact that it doesn't seem to want to address the radical extreme portions of the party that seem to have a racist kind of bent to them, that want to kind of go back to the old ways. And that to me has kind of turned me off of the party. And how is the party going to address that going forward?
Chris, thank you so much for that question. Gerard, what about racism?
Well, their message is not our message. If you look at the party's platform, you'll notice that we have focused on those issues that voters consider important to them. And certainly that element of any party that's extreme is not welcome. We have certainly made that case over and over and over again. You can't banish someone's thoughts. And if they happen to go to the polls and vote for Republican candidates, you know, we can't stop them from doing that, no more than the Democrats can stop those that they find unwelcome who somehow or the other find their ideas attractive to them or wish to affiliate with them. And so that's part of the conundrum of going out as a political party and trying to engage voters when you deliver the message to them.
Gerard, how do you square that when you're saying that the extremist views or racist views are not the views of the GOP, and yet former President Donald Trump has incredible support? We've seen support increasing for Trump among even Black men from 2016 to 2020. And Trump has been called racist, for instance, after he characterized white supremacists marching in South Carolina as, in his words, fine people. So you're saying that those aren't the views of the party, but the people who are leading the party have those views. Help me understand.
Well, you'd have to ask Donald Trump what he thinks. What I think is that the party does not represent those views, and that many of our candidates, in fact, I'd argue that most of our candidates carry the party's platform proudly and race as a negative factor is certainly not part of our platform. And we would rebuke anyone that would go out and overtly try to misrepresent the party's platform by indicating that race is certainly something that's negative.
Do you see that happening or not yet with any of the candidates?
I have not come across any candidate that has misrepresented the party's platform and touted negativity in terms of their approach to how they identify with people of color.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Republican Party's efforts to attract Black voters. Gerard Randall is the first vice chair of the state party and leads the party's African American Council. Gerard, what conservative positions do you see resonating with Black voters?
I think particularly economic issues. When you begin to take a look at where the economy was 4 years ago, prior to President Biden's taking office, the cost of staple items in grocery stores, the cost of gasoline, the rising cost of home mortgages. Those are some of the primary considerations that have won over so many people across ethnic and cultural lines to the Republican Party, because they recognize that the Republicans have a better economic agenda. You also take a look at jobs and job security. Republicans have done a better job of being able to deliver on that, even if you take into account the impact of COVID and what President Biden had supposedly corrected. The other is personal safety. And I like to characterize it as personal safety locally or globally. When it comes to safety in your neighborhoods, I think our message is a better message than what Democrats have delivered. And when you look at it globally, in terms of our ability to make sure that we address the threats that our citizens are having to face from either China, North Korea, or any of the others, even from the Middle East. We are certainly, I think, in a better position with candidates who can deliver that message to voters in a more credible way than what Democrats have been able to offer.
We will see how that turns out. We've got just more than a year left. It's coming up fast. Gerard, I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be on this morning. Thank you.
Gerard Randall is first vice chair of the Wisconsin Republican Party. He leads the state GOP's African American Council. He's also executive director of the Milwaukee Education Partnership. And in this conversation, we talked about how the state's Republican Party is trying to diversify its base and attract more people of color, talked about the issues that seem to be resonating better with Black voters and how those connect or don't to the Republican Party. And that's as Pew Research Center notes that about 1 in 10 Black adults currently identifies or leans toward the Republican Party. Good to have you here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to The Ideas Network.